I'd like to begin this talk today by talking about a Dharma talk, listening to a Dharma talk as a practice. So some of you know this and are familiar with this. Some of you have been on many retreats, but some of you are new to retreat, so it's worth saying. When we listen to a Dharma talk, it's a little different than listening to a lecture. We're used to that kind of presentation, somebody sitting in front of the room, and we're kind of listening and fitting it together with other things that we've learned, and and maybe listening critically, or like thinking of our questions, or thinking about what we might agree with or disagree with. So, and that's fine when you're building up a body of knowledge, and you are you're trying to fit different pieces together, and that body of knowledge is evolving. And in some ways, the Dharma can be approached that way, in a scholarly way, kind of building up your Dharma understanding. And it's, there are many wonderful Dharma scholars, and it's very, very useful and valuable. But when we're on retreat, it's a different kind of experience, where it's more like it's a more holistic kind of listening that we're doing. We're more it's more through you could say it's more through the heart than through the head, in a way. We're listening what resonates for us, what's useful for us right now, what word or phrase connects with our experience, shines a light on something that we may be, working with, gives us a tool to continue on in our exploration. And, if something doesn't fit, if something doesn't quite, connect with what you understand, you can let it go. It's okay. You might come across it later. It might and get it. Maybe the way I said it was not that clear, or it's not doesn't fit with the way you've heard things before. So it's not. Don't get stuck on things. Listen in a way which is kind of holistic. We could say listening with the whole body. That's another way of describing how we listen to the Dharma. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how we're practicing and meditation practice, and some thoughts in general. I'm going to talk a bit about the Anapanasati Sutta specifically, and the parts that we're going to be exploring. So Anapanasati, that word itself, is actually quite interesting. And the word ana has the same root as prana. Maybe some of you, especially those of you who practice yoga, might be familiar with the word prana. And it has a kind of meaning like life energy. It's something that's hard to put words on, but it has this. This sense of life energy, ana being the breathing in, and apana is the releasing, the like the exhaling, the letting go of what we can't use. And the word sati is the word which is translated mindfulness in English. And and mindfulness, you know, itself has some people have questioned what it, you know, how good a word it is. First of all, it has no French equivalent, so people have in French and probably other languages have you know, improvised new words or phrases to try to touch on what sati means. Many scholars have said that the sense of sati is more like remembering than being mindful. And so, you know, we've gotten the idea that mindfulness is all about the mind. You know, it's about and there's been a lot of focus on the brain in particular. You know, so, and some people feel that that's gotten a little out of balance. That really mindfulness is, Gil Fronsdale says, you know, it could have actually been translated bodyfulness, because it's so much about awareness in the body and presence in the body and remembering to be in the body. So we're remembering this flow of life in and out. Anapanasati is the remembering of this, of how life flows in and out. That's another translation. Something I just came up with, but I kind of like it. It also reminded me that the word for breath in English, the word for breath in the Abrahamic tradition, so in Hebrew, in and I don't know the Jewish scriptures, and it follows through in the Christian, and I'm not sure about the Islamic, but this sense of that God breathed life, you know. And so, I mean, you don't have to be theistic to get a sense that, you know, we don't have to take a literal sense of that, you know, the creation story that God breathed life, but that there is something about this breathing which is connected to spirit, to inspire, to inspiration, that is quite profound. So there are these connections these words that evoke deeper meanings and connections. It's quite interesting. The word mindfulness has been used a lot to talk about, you know, different aspects of meditative development. I think that the word mindfulness has, you know, gotten big, and I think that in Pali and other languages in which meditative experience is described, because there's, you know, there's a in the culture there's a deep cultivation and history of meditative practice. That there are many, many words to describe different kinds of developments of the mind that we kind of use mindfulness as an umbrella term for. But some of the things that we're talking about when we use the word mindfulness is the capacity to be aware in the moment of each experience of our senses, and including the mind. So in this system, the mind is considered the sixth sense, the thinking mind. So this capacity to be aware is often compared to a mirror. So that a mirror simply reflects what is there. It doesn't add anything. It's not thinking about, it's not trying to change, it's not trying to hold on to it. So this mirror mind is not trying to resist or push it away. And mindfulness is unbiased, the same way a mirror is. It's not for or against anything. So whatever is coming up in mindful awareness, whether it's joy or anger or fear or grasping or pain or grief or equanimity, it doesn't add or subtract, it doesn't judge, it just is present with. And yet, at the same time, mindfulness is not detached. It's not distant. So when I'm mindful of grieving, it's intimate. I'm intimate with the experience of grieving. When I'm mindful of joy or love, there's an intimacy, a closeness with that experience. It's fresh, immediate. It's not filtered through thoughts and judgments and ideas. An example that I think is helpful in expressing or in touching on mindfulness and how we experience through mindfulness is the experience of hearing a sound that you don't know what it is. Do you ever hear a sound and it's like, you know, what is that? And the mind is asking, what is that? But there's this listening, quite intent listening, and you're hearing maybe a resonance or a rhythm or a vibration, hearing the range of the sound, and then all of a sudden a perception clicks in, you know, oh, it's the faucet dripping, or oh, it's, you know, the recycling truck, or oh, it's, you know, a jackhammer in the distance or something, you know. And then what happens when, as soon as we label it, we stop listening, right? Because we've put it in a box, we've labeled it. But it was really interesting before we knew what it was, right? So mindfulness is kind of like that. So even when we know what something is, you know, we might label something. We might, we might say, this is chickpeas, you know. But, well, we don't really know what those chickpeas taste like until we eat them. So mindfulness stays intimate even when the perception names our experience. So mindfulness is knowing that you know. We talked about this before. There's a sharpness, there's a clarity of mind. Any Buddhist meditation has this quality of knowing. So, you know, if we're just kind of getting into a state of, you know, calm absorption, and the mind is very tranquil, if there's not that quality of knowing, a presence with the experience, then it's not Buddhist meditation, or it's not the essence of what we're trying to practice. There are probably many different practices in Buddhism that I don't know about. But this quality of knowing, you know, like what I talked about, the sharpness, the clarity is a very important aspect of our meditation practice. Another reflection on meditation practice that I recently heard from Gil Fronsdale, which I found very helpful. He said meditation practice stands on two legs. So it's noticing something that's happening in the present moment, and it's also noticing how we are relating to what is happening. And that's what brings clarity. So we can notice, I'm standing online, waiting to get my lunch. And so I can be aware that I'm standing, I can feel my body, and also what is my relationship to that experience of standing and slowly moving forward. So is there impatience? Is there agitation in the mind? Is there preoccupation? And then what's our relation to the agitation, if there's agitation? So then we notice the agitation. Is there acceptance? Is there judgment? So this is all how we practice mindfulness, just noticing what's happening, noticing how we're relating. Just as an aside, one of the things when I first started going to retreats quite a few years ago that I noticed was, exactly that experience of standing online and waiting to get your food, or going from the meditation hall to the dining hall. And in my own personal history, there was just a lot of craziness in my family around dinner time, food, eating too much, eating fast, and I began to notice, as I was in this meditative space and in this supportive environment, this extreme agitation in my body as I was walking to the dining hall and waiting online and eating. I would sit down and my plate of food would be in front of me, and then my mind would just go into this, all of these different thoughts and judgments and stories, and I wouldn't even know I was eating. I just lost. And just the whole, and then, my food's gone. So I remember I told that story once a couple of years ago, and Janet said to me, "Oh, I'm so glad you talked about that." So that was exactly my experience when I started going to retreats. So if it resonates for any of you, it's okay. C'est normal. it's nothing to feel worried about. Just bringing that space of knowing, that presence, that acceptance. The acceptance is quite implied, isn't it? If we can be with something, then we can accept it. And so again and again, opening to what is, and then the agitation begins to, whatever it is, whether it's around food or whether it's around, being in a relationship or whatever it is that pushes our buttons. So noticing what's happening and notice how we're relating to it. So noticing how we're relating to it is asking, what am I bringing to this experience? What am I bringing in this moment to this experience? And so we're bringing our conditioning, our conditioned minds. We're bringing our attitudes, who we happen to be in this moment. You know, what's conditioned us? Are we calm? Are we agitated? Are we feeling threatened? And we're bringing our perceptions, which are conditioned and are largely unconscious. So our perceptions are how we create reality. You know, how we perceive other people, how we perceive the world around us. I'm going to talk a little bit more about perception and it's how important it is in becoming more open. Because our perceptions are the names that we give to things and the judgments that we have around things and the beliefs that we hold around things. So the more that we recognize our perceptions, the more we recognize that a perception that we may hold is not the truth about what it is, it's simply a perception, then the more we can be open to other perspectives and be more open to other possibilities of truth beyond our own. So part of this noticing what we're bringing to our experience, and especially when we are clinging or grasping or trying to control our experience, which is always changing, that, and we're going to talk more about that when we talk about, you know, later in the discourse about seeing impermanence. But our relationship with what we're experiencing in each moment is what's pointed at in the Four Noble Truths, that the framing of the First Noble Truth. These are the Four Noble Truths. If you haven't heard this framework for teaching, is that there is suffering in life, and that there's a cause of suffering, which is trying to grasp and control our experience, that we can become free of suffering, and that there is a path to be free of suffering. And so one of the ways of framing or expressing the First Noble Truth is that we're not at ease. There's unease in our experience. So our relationship with our experience, which is inherently unstable, always changing, is one of dis-ease. Because we're in opposition to it. So notice. Notice if we feel uneasy. And our breath can help us notice if we feel uneasy. So if we feel uneasy, we're probably holding our breath or tightening our breath. So the breath can help us notice. It can be a kind of a little red light on our dashboard. We might notice that we're holding our breath. Or we might notice that we're feeling anxious and uneasy or whatever of the, you know, these emotional states that kind of fall into that broad category of dis-ease. And then we can come to our breath as a way of kind of shifting how we are and becoming a bit more comfortable and relaxed. So it works both ways. So in this discourse, we actually do get actively involved with using the breath as a tool to begin to release and relax some of the difficult states.
Are people getting cold?
And that goes a little bit contrary to what some Vipassana teachers teach, you know, that and it's a very mainstream approach to Vipassana is like you don't, when your experience comes up, when you feel, you know, anxiety, just be with it, just know it, just allow it to be, don't try to shift it or change it in any way. And just see the nature of it, see the impermanent nature of it, see the suffering nature of it, and see the selfless nature of it. See that it's not who you are. When I say selfless, I mean what I'm pointing to is that we are seeing that our dis-ease comes from causes and conditions. It's not who we are. So when I feel inadequate, or when I feel self-judgment or anger, and I'm aware, I become aware of it, seeing an insight into it shows me that it's not who I am. It's not essentially who I am. It's something that is coming up because of inner and outer conditions. Something triggered an old pattern that I have. You know, my father used to yell at me, and then somebody raises their voice a little bit, and I freak out. Because I overreact. Right? So these triggers, we have them. The Buddhist shorthand for that is causes and conditions, like experiences, conditionings in our life, you know, and that points to the selfless nature of these reactions, the suffering that we experience. So the Vipassana approach is largely, and this is in the Vipassana stream, but there's been an emphasis, I think, on just know it. And in this Anapanasati discourse, it says, well, yes, know it and open to it with mindfulness, and you can also, like, use the breath as a kind of an ally, a friend, a skillful means to soften. You can soften into it. You can use the breath to help you maybe let go a little bit, to relax a little bit, because we hold with our bodies, and the breath can help us let go of that. So this process, as we move into awareness and sensitivity within the whole body, feeling the breath in the whole body, and we become aware, mindful of the body, in the body, and we give space for experiences in the body to simply be. And a way of seeing this meditation is having a profound respect for life, giving our full attention to whatever we're experiencing. Whatever we're experiencing in the body, in the feelings, or in the mind. Ancient Chinese Zen masters, Chan masters, used to say that when we're tuned out of our experiences, so when we're kind of drifting into our thoughts, into our dream states, into our inner, you know, monologues or imagined dialogues, caught up in fantasies and so on, that we're killing life. So when we're disconnected from our experiences, that we're killing life. It's kind of dramatic. And what it means, well, I think what they're saying is that we're not fully alive. You know, we're rehashing our old experiences. We're just rehashing and rehashing. We're not living fully in the present. And when we are mindful, and when we're living fully in each moment, the expression is that we're giving life to life. I love that. We're giving life to life. So our life is flowing into life. So let me talk a little bit about the sutta itself. So the Anapanasati, just setting the scene, it begins with the Buddha staying at a large park, called Savatthi. And there were many, many of senior disciples, and then the elder monks were teaching younger monks. And the word monks is used for both male and female, and sometimes the word bhikkhu is used, and it's both, you know, in, I don't know about this particular, but in the teachings, the word bhikkhu is used to refer not just to ordained, but to all people who are dedicated to practicing these teachings. And so the Buddha looked out and he saw all this wonderful practice going on, and he was really delighted. He said, said, monks, I'm pleased with this practice. I'm pleased at heart. And then he said, in fact, I think it's so wonderful that I'm going to stay an extra month. So they were going to stay through the 3 months of the rains retreat. But he said, I'm going to stay it another month. And then the word got out to folks around, and more people came, and they were practicing, and then at the end of those 4 months, the Buddha said, you know, look at all this this wonderful practice that's happening. He said, this assembly is without frivolous talk. This assembly is established on pure heartwood, and it's an assembly worthy of offerings, worthy of hospitality, worthy of gifts. It's an unsurpassable field of merit for the world. Such is this community of monks. Such is this assembly. So it was pretty nice. And then he began to talk about all the different practices that were being done there. And at the end of listing a number of different practices, he talked about mindfulness of breathing. And he said, mindfulness of breathing in and out is of great fruit and great benefit when cultivated and made much of. And when cultivated and made much of, the four applications, this is Gil Fronsdale's translation, for foundations is, it's actually, scholars have said, oh, that's actually foundations, it sounds too much like a thing, you know. So they've used, I've heard the Joseph Goldstein use the word arenas of mindfulness, arenas for applying. Gil Fronsdale uses the translation applications of mindfulness. The four applications of mindfulness, the breathing in and breathing out brings the four applications of mindfulness to fulfillment. When cultivated and made much of, the four applications of mindfulness bring the seven factors of awakening to fulfillment. And when cultivated and made much of, the seven factors of awakening bring knowledge and freedom to fulfillment. And so now I'm going to read the 16 tetrads. So how, monks, is mindfulness of breathing in and out of great fruit and great benefit when cultivated and made much of? Here, having gone to the wilderness, a foot of a tree or an empty building, a monk sits down with legs crossed and body erect, establishing mindfulness to the forefront, always attentive. One breathes in with mindfulness and breathes out with mindfulness. So then comes the two that we worked on this morning. Breathing in long, one knows I am breathing in long. Breathing in short, one knows I am breathing in short. Breathing out long, one knows I am breathing out long. Breathing out short, one knows I am breathing out short. So those are the only two of the 16 tetrads, or stanzas, that are actually focusing fully on the breath itself. It changes, the form of each of these tetrads changes now, and it begins, one trains oneself. So one trains oneself. This is number three. Breathing in, I experience the whole body. Breathing out, I experience the whole body. So we were doing a little bit of that this morning. Breathing in, I experience the whole body. One trains oneself. Breathing in, I calm the bodily formation. Breathing out, I calm the bodily formation. So we're going to do a little bit more of that later today. So working on breathing in and bringing calmness, noticing where is the body tense, where is the body stressed. One trains oneself. I will breathe in, experiencing joy. One trains oneself. I will breathe out, experiencing joy. So what happens is that joy arises. As the body becomes calm, we connect with joy. And so in the teaching on Anapanasati, the instruction is to notice it and cultivate it. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, experiencing pleasure. One trains oneself, I will breathe out, experiencing pleasure. So pleasure is a little more subtle than joy, getting into the subtleties of meditative delights here. Next, number 8. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, calming the mental formation. I will breathe out, calming the mental formation. So we calm the body. Now, with the breath, connecting, staying connected to the breath, calming the mind. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, experiencing the mind. I will breathe out, experiencing the mind. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, pleasing the mind. One trains oneself, I will breathe out, pleasing the mind. Again, these are just all subtle developments of bringing more calm and presence, awareness in the mind. We're going to move to some of the later ones, as I described this morning, but I'm just reading these. I will breathe in, concentrating the mind. I will breathe out, concentrating the mind. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, releasing the mind. I will breathe out, releasing the mind. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, observing impermanence. I will breathe out, observing impermanence. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, observing dispassion. One trains oneself, I will breathe out, observing dispassion. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, observing cessation. One trains oneself, I will breathe out, observing cessation. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, observing relinquishment. I will breathe out, observing relinquishment. So we're going to talk more about impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and relinquishment later tomorrow and Saturday. That's what's on the agenda. Monks, this is how cultivating and making much of mindfulness of breathing in and breathing out is of great fruit and great benefit. So there's a lot that could be talked about, and maybe your mind is questioning. What's this dispassion thing? Is that really what I want? But we're going to talk more about that. If questions have arisen in your mind, just put them on the shelf for now, if you can. So, a few more points. So I pointed out that it's only the first two tetrads in which we are really that the mind, that the breath itself is the object of our meditation, and as we move into the third and beyond, we're actually using the breath as a kind of tether to keep us present in the moment, to bring us back to the moment and maintain that stability of attention, maintain that concentration and focus, so that we can really investigate and explore these different unfoldings of our experience. And I think of it, one of the ways I think of this kind of this breath as just this kind of home base that keeps calling us back. It reminds me of a Rumi poem. Rumi talks about the drumbeat of a falconer calling the falcon back. And so I think, you know, that we let our breath keep calling us back, keep calling us home. Here's the poem. It's very short. Sometimes you hear a voice through the door calling you, as fish out of water hear the waves, or a hunting falcon hear the drums come back. This turning toward what you deeply love saves you. I'll have to read it again. Sometimes you hear a voice through the door calling you, as fish out of water hear the waves, or a hunting falcon hears the drums come back. This turning toward what you deeply love saves you. I'll just end there. Maybe we can sit for a few minutes before we move on to our next.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.